Hi friends, this is Justin Hibbard from Why Catholic with a brief message before we begin today's episode. Whenever I find something that is life-changing, I love to share it with the world. It's why I started the Why Catholic podcast, and it's also why I started a program called Trade to Live, where I teach people how to options trade. That's right, I've been an options trader since about 2010. In fact, I've been an options trader longer than I've been Catholic. Options trading has been life-changing for me, allowing me to focus on the more important things in life, like family and faith. Maybe you're just curious or want to earn some extra money, or maybe you want to consider a career change. Check out my options trading program at tradetolive.substack.com. That's tradetolive.substack.com. Oh, and if you decide to move forward, I have a special discount for you. Just go to tradetolive.substack.com/whycatholic. Truth be told, I'm not much of a Star Wars fan. And for that matter, I'm not much of a Star Trek fan either. I know that makes me a minority among my fellow Americans, but I've never been one to stand in line to see the first showing of the latest Star Wars movie, though I have seen the majority of them. It's quite a phenomenon, isn't it? There's this intoxicating craze about the Star Wars movies that it's not uncommon to see people dress up as Star Wars characters to catch the premiere. And I'm talking about grown adults here. And it's not just Star Wars. There are other fantasy series like Harry Potter that don't just capture the imagination of patrons, but actually lure them into the story. And while these stories are different, there's a similar theme, a prevailing evil that's threatening peace, and up comes an unlikely hero who, against all odds, saves the day. So many of our cherished movies follow this arc. Star Wars, Braveheart, The Matrix. We could make a list that goes on and on. Hi, this is Justin Hibbard, and you're listening to Why Catholic, my podcast about the what and why of Catholicism. Since episode 83, we've been in a series focusing on the nature of God. We've looked at God and his nature as Trinity, the diversity of his personality, his existence beyond our limits of time and space, his role as Father, his pre-incarnate appearances, and today I want to examine his imagination and his ability to capture ours. In the last episode, I proposed a puzzle. Why was it that God told Moses that nobody could see his face and live, and yet we see God face to face with a variety of Old Testament characters such as Abraham, Jacob, and Joshua, to name a few? The answer I proposed was that these face-to-face encounters with God can be understood best if we recognize these seemingly human appearances as the second person of the Trinity, God the Son, appearing in human form. In other words, these appearances were Jesus before his incarnation and before his parents named him Jesus. This brings us to another puzzle. If God the Son could appear in human form, then why was the incarnation even necessary? Why did God have to be born of a virgin and come to die? Why couldn't he have just appeared as a man like a warrior, as was the case when he appeared to Joshua, and seized the day? The answer I want to propose centers around a conversation that J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of the Lord of the Rings series, had with his friend C.S. Lewis, the author of the Chronicles of Narnia. This conversation took place when C.S. Lewis was 32 years old, long before he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia. He was a fellow at Oxford at the time, and he was also an atheist. One evening, he, Tolkien, and a mutual friend named Hugo Dyson stayed up late into the wee hours of the morning talking about love and myth and literature and eventually Christianity. At some point, Lewis referred to Christianity as a myth, which was neither off-putting nor offensive to Tolkien, who was a lifelong Catholic. Tolkien used Lewis's frame of reference of myth to help him understand that Christianity was the great myth from which all other myths derived. Later, in a letter to his friend Arthur Graves, C.S. Lewis wrote, quote, "Now, what Dyson and Tolkien showed me was this, that if I met the idea of sacrifice in a pagan story, I didn't mind it at all. Again, that if I met the idea of a god sacrificing himself to himself, I liked it very much and was mysteriously moved by it. Again, that the idea of the dying and reviving god, Balder, Adonis, Bacchus, similarly moved me, provided I met it anywhere except in the Gospels. The reason was that in pagan stories, I was prepared to feel the myth as profound and suggestive of meanings beyond my grasp, even though I could not say in cold prose what it meant. Now, the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference, that it really happened. End quote. So back to the question, why was the incarnation necessary? The answer is, I'm not sure that it was. What I mean by that is to say that I don't believe God had no other choice but to make the incarnation happen. Rather, I think God has the imagination for the theatrical, for the dramatic, for the perfect story. It would be a mistake to think of him as an efficient God who only cares about getting from point A to Z. But rather, we ought to think of him as a masterful producer like Steven Spielberg or James Cameron, who goes out of his way to tell the most compelling story in the most grandiose manner. Or we should think of him as an artist like Michelangelo. God is not interested in just producing a story. He's in the business of producing the greatest story, the greatest myth, with the greatest details. God could have redeemed the world in any way he saw fit. Think of the Exodus story. God didn't need to do any of those plagues, nor did he need to part the Red Sea. He could have just annihilated the Egyptians, and one day the Hebrews would have woken up as the sole inhabitants of the land of Egypt. Instead, he brought the Hebrews through a story of universal proportions. Even 40 years later and hundreds of miles removed, the inhabitants of Canaan were still talking about that story. And we still talk about it today. Why? Because it's a story unlike any other. And so I think it is the same with the incarnation and the story of Jesus as a whole. I imagine God saying, how can I make this story the most extravagant and the most compelling? And so he thinks of the unthinkable. God would not just appear as a man, but he would become a man through a birth, but not just any birth, a virgin birth. And God would not just redeem man through the shedding of blood, but through the shedding of his blood. He would experience the fullness of man, birth through death. But this wouldn't be the end of the story. The unlikely hero would rise again and defeat Satan, sin, and death once for all. And I want to suggest to you that God knew this plan all along. You might ask, if God knew that Adam and Eve would sin, why did he create the world? Or you might ask the question, if God knew Adam and Eve would eventually sin, does that mean that they had no other choice but to sin? The answer to that, I believe, can be found in episode 85 called The Metaphysics of a Personal God. In that episode, I talked about God outside of our limits of time and space. We examined how time is relative while the speed of light is constant. Therefore, God, the creator of light, is not bound by time. Whereas we experience a past, a single moment, which we call the present, and a theoretical future, God likely experiences all of time in his present. And if that seems impossible to imagine, know that I also cannot imagine it, but only conceptualize a theory. All of my experience has been human in nature, past, present, and future. But not so with God. May I suggest to you that God, knowing the whole story and how it would unfold, etched it into the fabric of our souls, in the same way an author foreshadows events in earlier pages. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, quote, "He has set eternity in our hearts," end quote. This particular story, the myth of goodness conquering evil in the most unexpected way, moves all of us. We're drawn to the story because God has etched this great myth into our being. When we see glimpses of it, it lures us, and this is why we dress as superheroes or Star Wars characters or imagine ourselves at Hogwarts. It's why myth has always been central to our storytelling. God has designed it that way. And like C.S. Lewis recognized, the whole world embraces it, provided we meet it anywhere except in the Gospels. Lewis would go on to write in his essay, Myth Became Fact, quote,
"Now, as myth transcends thought, incarnation transcends myth. The heart of Christianity is myth, which is also a fact. The old myth of the dying god without ceasing to be myth comes down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date, in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We pass from a Balder or an Osiris dying nobody knows when or where, to a historical person crucified, it is all in order, under Pontius Pilate. By becoming fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. I suspect that men have sometimes derived more spiritual sustenance from myths they did not believe than from the religion they professed. To be truly Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and also receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord to all myths. The one is hardly more necessary than the other. End quote.
Let me emphasize a sentence buried in this paragraph. Quote, I suspect that men have sometimes derived more spiritual sustenance from myths they did not believe than from the religion they professed. End quote. How many of us have lined up to see the movie premiere of some myth with great anticipation and then begrudgingly attended Mass or maybe skipped Mass altogether? How many children would rather play video games that they know are not real than come to Mass and enter into the story that is real? 70% of American Catholics can't bring themselves to acknowledge the true body and blood of Jesus in the Eucharist, yet I wonder how many of them get lost in their favorite fictional myth. There's a show I've always enjoyed called The Big Bang Theory. It's a sitcom about four nerdy scientists who work at Caltech. It's a massive caricature all around, which of course adds to the comedic effect. For example, one of the primary characters, Sheldon Cooper, hails from Texas and has a mom who is a caricature of an evangelical Christian. Sheldon, as an enlightened scientist, is convinced that Christianity is a brainwashing hoax. Yet at the same time, Sheldon is obsessed with fictional myths. He could tell you which comic book number to find Spider-Man doing such and such, which Battlestar Galactica episode you might find this or that, or which Star Trek series and episode you would find whichever exact scenario. He spends an enormous amount of time and mental energy on myths he knows are not true while mocking Christianity. I would like to offer that imagination is precisely the culprit of this epidemic. Adults want us to act like adults at Mass, when really we ought to be acting like children, well, so to speak. As Lewis notes, we ought not make the mistake of harnessing our imagination within the myths we know are fiction, but leave our imagination at the door when it comes to the myth of Christianity, which we believe to be true. As he says, quote, to be truly Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and also receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord to all myths, end quote. After all, it was the imagination of God that brought us the great myth of the Incarnation. Why would God ask us to leave our imagination at the door to embrace him? But rather, the imagination of God requires our imagination to participate in his. What movie producer, after all, would ask us to leave our imagination at the theater entrance? No, we need somewhat of an imagination to imagine a world where E.T. exists. However, it's not merely enough to embrace Christianity as we might with other myths, whether that be Star Wars or Harry Potter or Greek mythology. It is one thing to be dressed up as Thor for Halloween or Luke Skywalker for a Star Wars premiere, but it is quite another to be clothed in Christ all the time. Christianity is not just a fictional myth, but a factual myth, a true myth which is written into the very fabric of our universe and our souls. And as such, it doesn't demand our temporary make-believe, but rather our entire imagination. So once again, I will ask why the Incarnation? And the answer I wish to propose is that it has to be this way because we are this way. It's what God designed, not just for the story of the redemption of man, but for the story of mankind itself. We are hopeless romantics because God made us this way, and the hopeless romantic demands a love story. And what better love story is there than this? While we were still sinners, the God of the universe came down from his throne, became one of us, and died for us. And 3 days later, he rose from the dead. Thank you for joining me for Why Catholic. Be sure to subscribe to Why Catholic wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also subscribe to my Substack site and get the next episode in your email inbox. As a subscriber, you get a special discount code to the Why Catholic Etsy store. If you've been blessed by this podcast and you're feeling generous, there's also a way to financially support it, and patrons get some extra perks. To become a free subscriber or a patron, just go to whycatholic.substack.com/subscribe. Also join me on Instagram at Why Catholic Podcast, all one word. Thanks again for listening. My name is Justin Hibbard, and this is Why Catholic. God bless you.